Our next case, 12-287, Disciplinary Counsel versus Michael Brian Dockery. For the respondent, Mr. Juhas.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. If it pleases the court, I'm John Juhas. I represent the respondent in this case, Michael Dockery. If it pleases the court, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The facts in this case are not in dispute, and I don't have much to say. There is, as the court is aware from reading the party's submissions, one objection here, and that objection is to the proposed sanction in this case. And our sole point in this case is that given the facts of the case as were presented to the panel and to the Board of Commissioners, that a stayed suspension with the conditions that were recommended is a punishment that is sufficient to protect the public in this case. The difference between the parties, at least as I read the submission, seems to be that the disciplinary counsel believes that any time there's an 8.4 violation, there must be an actual suspension. With due respect, I would say two things to that. One is that it seems to me in reading this court's discipline cases that there is one immutable rule, and that immutable rule is that there is not always predictability in how these cases will come out because of the true immutable rule, which is that the court looks at the particular facts of every case individually. And so it's very difficult to pigeonhole these cases. But even with that said, the second point that I'd like to make with regard to the disciplinary counsel's argument is that the Fumich case appears to sort of debunk that theory. That's a case where, if the court will recall, a lawyer actually lied to some relatives about a settlement from someone who had died. The lawsuit had been dismissed. The lawyer misrepresented to the family that the lawsuit had been dismissed. Actually, as I recall, took some money from his own retirement accounts and in essence, created a settlement. And the court in that case found that the dishonesty factor, the predecessor of the current 8.4C, had been violated, but nonetheless imposed a stayed suspension. And I think the point raised in Fumich and a couple of the other cases we cited, the Vivian case, the Fletcher case, and the Johnston case, all pretty much make the same point, which is that when we look at the facts and when we compare the mitigation in the cases, and the mitigation in those cases is essentially the same as the mitigation in this case. No prior disciplinary record. The respondent in this case was completely forthright and cooperative in the disciplinary process. I think if you look at the transcript of the record hearing, you will find that he is embarrassed and genuinely remorseful, not simply that he violated the disciplinary code, but I believe the embarrassment from simply not understanding what his requirements were.
Well, counsel, when you argue that this should be a fully stayed suspension and cite, you know, reference to other cases that you believe are parallel with this case, in the reply brief of the relator here, those are distinguished from isolated incidences such as the Kramer case to compared with your client, who I believe this was an ongoing course of conduct with him and that he actually converted client's money to his own use on two occasions.
Actually, I would say two things about that, Chief Justice O'Connor. One is I think the case is cited by the disciplinary counsel. There are additional facts present that there are not in this case that justified the panel and the court ultimately imposing a greater sanction. Secondly, with regard to the conversion, there were two instances where the panel and the board found a loan. There was actually some disagreement, and as the first one, there's no question about it. He looked online at his personal account, saw that it was overdrawn. As I recall, that turned out actually to be a mistake, and covered that for a couple of days with money from his IOLT account, which was put back within, I think, 3 days. The second one was a loan to his former law associate, and the dispute between the parties there had to do with restitution, and I guess highlights the difficulty with a case like this, because he was reluctant to put money back into the account because he believed that the original loan made to Mr. Pritchard had been made from money that, while in his IOLTA account, was money that did not belong to a client, belonged to Mr. Dockery. And so the heel dragging at first was, in essence, well, you're telling me to put money into my account that I shouldn't be doing, because my claim as to that second loan was that that was money, although improperly in there, but money that did not belong to a client.
Which points to the whole issue here is that he had gotten himself so convoluted with his management of his IOLTA account over the years, so mismanaged that when a problem did present itself, he was in a quandary. How do I get out from the wrongful conduct that precipitated it to begin with, and now I've got layered on top of that another issue that actually can be interpreted and was interpreted and found to be even more egregious?
I do not dispute that in terms of the facts. What I'm simply saying is, in terms of, if you look at the mitigation, the fact that he's a 30-year lawyer with no prior discipline, good character, actually a small number of clients, and the major client who he represents on evictions wrote a character letter for him. So when you bundle all those things together and look at the protection of the public, we're talking about a fairly small client pool. And while I'm not disputing anything that you've said, Madam Chief Justice, as far as the facts, what I am saying is that the stayed suspension with the monitor, he has, since this case began, demonstrated to the disciplinary council that he has learned how to do the reconciliation and the ledgers. We furnished those to the disciplinary council, and all we're simply saying is that a stayed suspension with a monitor to make sure that he continues along that way will ensure that those things that you've just cited do not occur in the future. And unless there are questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Mr. King.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. And may it please the court. My name is Philip King, and I'm Assistant Disciplinary Counsel. I'm here on behalf of the Relator, the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. And what Relator is asking is for this court to adopt the recommendation of the Board of Commissioners on Grievance and Discipline that the respondent be suspended from the practice of law for a full year with 6 months stayed on the condition that the respondent be monitored by an attorney selected by the relator. Now, this is a misappropriation case involving an attorney who put his personal funds into his IOLTA account and then made expenses, paid his personal expenses and business expenses. And then on two occasions, he used his IOLTA account for personal loans. And to answer...
And how long was that going on?
This was going on for years, so at least 2009, probably back before that and consistently. And I'd like to address the question about the both instances of the borrowing. As Mr. Ruhas pointed out, Mr. Dockery admitted the first that occurred in April 2009, in which he borrowed $2,000 of client funds. The second, what we were there at the hearing, and up until that point, Mr. Dockery had not submitted sufficient client records, IOLTA records, to show that the funds that were used in April 2010 were his. And the panel chair put the burden squarely on Mr. Dockery, citing Wise, saying that it's your burden. You know, you opened up the IOLTA account. It's your job to show that those aren't client funds, that those are your personal funds. So the chair allowed the parties, Mr. Dockery and disciplinary counsel, time after the hearing to figure that out so Mr. Dockery could get the client records. And there is a stipulation in the case that was entered subsequently that it was determined that that second, the April 2010 withdrawal was Mr. Dockery's personal funds. But at the same time, it revealed that just the month before, in February 2010, he had used $100 from another client. So that wasn't charged. But what that shows is that it's not just one instance, but there was not a separate charge.
So the April 10th, 2010, they were personal funds. They weren't client funds that were being manipulated in the account.
Correct.
Yet the deposit of those personal funds in the account is a problem.
Correct. That's commingling just the same.
Okay. And Mr. King, were there any clients that were harmed financially with respect to any of the time that the IOLTA was mismanaged?
No. I mean, the clients didn't know. So Mr. Doctry had borrowed the money without the client's knowledge. So ultimately, it was replaced before the clients were aware.
So no restitution is due and owing in this case?
No, not at this point. We made sure that that was complete at the time of the hearing. Now, this is a time-off case. That's really all it is. And the Board of Commissioners, their conclusion of law that we had two violations here. We've got the 1.15A, which is the commingling, and then we've got the 8.4C, which is the converting of the client funds. And as Mr. Rujas pointed out, there's no objections concerning the facts, those violations, and also the aggravating factor of a selfish or dishonest motive. So what he is asking for...
What's the selfish and dishonest motive here?
The selfish and dishonest motive was exactly that... that he used these funds to make sure that he avoided this discrepancy in his personal account and did not ask permission before doing that. So essentially, his IOLTA account was a bank.
Do we have an admission that he realized while he was doing it that this was not the appropriate way to manage an IOLTA account?
Yes.
I mean, so he realizes that.
He realized that. And in fact, the check.
He did it anyway for at least three, maybe more years.
Correct.
There's no dispute that he knew what he was doing was contrary to the disciplinary rules.
Correct. And in fact, the check that he wrote the check for $2,000, and the check from the personal account to repay the funds actually said to repay loan. In the memo section of the check.
But I thought he said something that he didn't realize this was wrong. I mean, he didn't keep good records, but I thought there was something in the record that he did not realize that he was violating the disciplinary rules.
He acknowledged there was always a disagreement as to the proper sanction, and there was a disagreement, or let's say the evidence did not show. At that time, Mr. Doctry could not prove that the second instance was not client funds. He was maintaining that they were his funds.
I mean, he stipulated that he violated, but he didn't at the time realize he was violating the rules when he did it. Or
no, he did.
Okay.
Only because he knew enough with the first instance to put the money back. It was immediate. He did not. He took it, and then it was actually strange, but. 2 days later, I mean, he borrowed the money literally for a couple of days and placed it right back. And it was, with the hope that no one would notice. So he acknowledged that this was wrong. It was just the second one that he was saying that was my money. So therefore, as Chief Justice O'Connor pointed out, that's a commingling problem. But what he was saying that specifically wasn't a conversion problem.
Counsel, how were these violations uncovered? No client funds were lost. Apparently there was no insufficient funds noticed, at least as I remember. How did these come to light?
Well, what I did was I subpoenaed the IOLTA records and went through them and had to piece them together. The respondent, Mr. Doctry at the time, didn't have these client ledgers to do so. So I had to actually go through and connect the dots in order to come up with what clients' funds were available at the time, what should be there, what shouldn't be there. And then I brought it to Mr. Doctry's attention to have him determine whether or not what I found was accurate, and he confirmed that.
Did it come to your attention because the account, the IOLTA account, had been overdrawn?
Correct.
So there was a bank notification from the bank where the account is held to your office that there is some deficiency in connection with the funding?
Correct.
And based on that, you began your investigation?
Exactly.
I'm having trouble distinguishing between conversion of funds or theft of the funds and this claim that they were borrowed and then repaid.
Okay.
Has our case analysis gone into those distinctions in mismanagement of IOLTA accounts?
Well, it actually says that regardless of the way the misappropriation occurs, whether it is commingling, whether it's conversion, whether it's poor judgment, regardless of the amount in question, regardless of the duration of the borrowing, it's all dishonest. So really, you've got a conversion when you have misused client funds for your own purpose or that of another beyond the purpose of the client.
What weight do we give to the fact that there are two instances, a $2,000 check and a $300 check over a 30-year legal career?
Well, the weight that you give is basically you give him, I mean, it requires time off. So the weight we're giving is...
Well, no, wait a minute.
Sorry.
Where is it written that it requires time off?
Well, the Reek case...
Well, yeah, but that's a case. There is no rule that requires time off.
Right. And I'm being zealous in my advocacy. The precedent that's set by this court, there has been no case, as we pointed out in our brief, with those two rule violations for an 8.4C and a 115A in which there has not been time off. And the case law that we cited in the brief.
You argue there should be time off here, and the respondent is arguing that the infractions here are of a nature that we should at least consider in light of the rest of his career as a lawyer, not giving time off.
Right. And my argument is based, and I'm simply asking the court to do what is already done, to follow the precedent that this court has set.
We try to look at each one of these individually.
Correct. But you don't look at them in a vacuum. You compare them to previous case law. And based on the previous case law, this is a time-off case. This is a case in which you've got a respondent. And, in fact, the two cases that we cited, it is analogous because with the Hawk and the Wright case, you've got the same two violations, a 1.15A and an 8.4C. You've got the same aggravation, the selfish and dishonest motive. You've got the same mitigation, no prior discipline, cooperation with disciplinary proceedings, and good character. So you've got those two cases that are on all fours with this case. And in those two cases, this court gave an actual suspension of 6 months with conditions. So this is perfectly in line. And finally, really, we're asking the court to do what it's always done in order to ensure the public confidence in the legal profession and not undermine the seriousness of this misconduct. This court has already held that this barment is the presumptive sanction for misappropriation of client funds. And violations involving dishonesty, misrepresentation, as stated in the Hawk case, generally require an actual suspension. And here, allowing a fully staged suspension is going to create bad precedent that's going to send a message to attorneys that, hey, I can misappropriate client funds and it's not going to affect my license.
What about the Vivian case that the respondent cites, the lawyer of 40 years who, over a period of 2 years, apparently was mismanaging the IOLTA account, very similarly to what we have here? You're talking about no precedent, but in that case, there was a one-year suspension, all stayed.
Okay. And again, those cases are just involving 1.15A, a commingling. The Fletcher case, there's LaRue, and these are cases that I was involved with, those are cases in which, and I would concede, in fact, if this was only a 1.15A, it would be my position that he might deserve a fully state suspension. But because we're dealing with a 1.4C, and the cases that I cite, the dishonesty didn't even have to involve client funds. They were other acts of dishonesty as well. One client actually misrepresented the bank account as an IOTA account. He was actually using the account for a nonprofit business, and it was just the lie was the 8.4C. So whatever misrepresentation you have, when it's coupled with the 1.15A, you've got time off.
But if you look at 8.4 and 8.4C and H, the dishonesty or the reflecting on the lawyer's fitness to practice law, I think that the respondent points out those could really be attached to almost every disciplinary violation that is alleged against an attorney. Could it not?
I disagree. Relator disagrees. And the 8.4C was specifically charged for the conversion. There was no other. The 1.15A commingling, 8.4C conversion. Had we not had the conversion, we would have not had an 8.4C.
And the conversion relates again to?
Exactly.
To which specific fact?
Specifically him using client funds for his own purpose. Those personal loans in which he borrowed temporarily his client funds without permission.
That's the $300 money?
Actually, no, that's a $2,000.
But I thought that was his own personal funds.
No, the $2,000 was client funds. The $300 was his own personal. So the first one was the one that he readily admitted that those were client funds. So that's what we have here, and that's the reason why we're asking for an actual suspension in light of this court's precedent. To ensure public confidence in the legal profession and not to undermine the seriousness of this conduct, Relator is asking this court to adopt the board's recommendation that respondent be suspended for 1 year with 6 months stayed upon the conditions stated in the board's report. Thank you.
Mr. Uras.
I do first and foremost want to address something because we do have a disagreement about what the facts are, and I believe the record supports our contention. And this goes back to the question that Chief Justice O'Connor asked and Justice McGee Brown asked. The record's very clear. When it comes to the loan, he does write on their loan. That's the one that he repays back in a couple of days. When it comes to the other violations, the record's very clear that, and that's the embarrassment that I talked about when I was up here previously, he did not know that he could not put his own money in there. He simply thought that as long as he paid client obligations out of there, it was okay to put his own money in.
How would you not know that? Isn't that one of the very basic principles of being a lawyer and the prohibition against the requirement to safekeep clients' funds, that you keep them strictly segregated? How could, in practice for 30 years, how could you not know that?
I will say two things, and I do not mean to be coy in the response.
Fine.
First of all, I obviously don't know the answer to that. Second of all, I will tell you that's not the only time that I have run across that. I think that as best I can discern the thinking on this, it is that I know that I have to keep client money segregated in there, and so as long as I do that, I'm in compliance with the rule. I'm not trying to dance around you. That's the best answer.
Trying to understand how somebody might not.
And that is part of the embarrassment that he testifies to in front of the panel, is I can't believe I was this far wrong about this. And it is a source of embarrassment to him. So I did want to make that clear, that the record, in my estimation, is very clear about that, that he did not know, incredible or not, that he did not know. A couple of other things that I wanted to address. There was a stipulation to a selfish or dishonest motive, but that's because the way Section 10 is worded. In this case, there's no question based upon the record that he is very forthright, he is very contrite, he's very remorseful about what happened, and he does stipulate that there's a selfish motive here. When I did this, it was obviously for my own benefit. He may not know, as Justice Cupp suggested, he may not know all of the requirements of the rule, but he certainly does understand being candid with Board of Commissioners and the Disciplinary Council and the investigation, and that was the reason for the acknowledgement, not that there was a dishonest motive, but that he stipulated to selfishness. Finally, pardon me, as I listen to the Disciplinary Council, I'm almost struck with the suggestion that stayed cases apparently don't send a message to lawyers in this state, and I would heartily disagree with that. We are, as we all know, obliged to protect the public in these cases, and the fact that this gentleman now recognizes what he was doing was so far off the beam, the fact that he has, to the satisfaction, to the proof of the Disciplinary Council, been doing the client ledgers and client reconciliations, the fact that he will gratefully accept the monitor and the help in making sure that he flies right.
Well, counsel, based on your statement about the impact of a stayed suspension versus an actual imposition, apparently your client didn't read any of the cases that have come before this with regard to the commingling, or the light would have gone on, I would presume.
Do you think
he was reading those cases and saying, well, I guess I'm doing okay because I can account for my client's funds. They're segregated. I'm not touching my client's funds. I'm mixing my own money in, but I don't see any case law that tells me that that's a problem.
I cannot disagree with that. And I don't know if he wasn't reading those cases, if he wasn't understanding those cases, but if you look at his testimony at the hearing and his deposition, I think it's very clear that he had a genuine misunderstanding. And so, once again, I'm really not debating any of the facts. The facts are what they are, and they're not all particularly flattering in terms of the violations. I do think what is the salvation in this case is what Justice Pfeiffer suggested, which is that you look at these cases individually. When you look at the mitigation in this case and the mitigation in the other cases, I do think that a stayed suspension with the conditions will ensure protection of the public and that Mr. Dockery does not commit any future violations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Thank you, gentlemen.